I do appreciate, as always, everybody's presence here this evening. And unless you forgot that it was Thanksgiving on Thursday, it was Thanksgiving on Thursday. And it is always good and typically traditional, a lot of families this time of year, to be thankful for the things that we have, to enumerate on the many blessings that surround us, both in this country, a country of great abundance and blessing, and in our families as well. Even when we're in the midst of trials, even when we're facing great suffering in this physical life, we can't help but be grateful to God for the things that He has done for us in this world. Even the worst off Americans are blessed enough to recognize that they have a pretty enviable life when you compare that life to the way that a lot of other people live in this world. We have homes, we have friends, we have family, we have these possessions, all things to be enjoyed, and God has in fact empowered us to enjoy those things, at least to a degree, when we do have them. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verses 18 through 20, the writer of Ecclesiastes does make it very clear that it is God's intention, when you have good things in this life, to enjoy those good things. Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and to enjoy oneself and all one's labor, in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this, he says, is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given these things, riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. And of course, that's not saying that God is going to go out of his way to bless just good people and bring only bad things on bad people, because we do know that the rain falls on the righteous and the good. The book of Lamentations points out that does not both good and ill come forth from the hand of the Lord? We know that even the bad times in life are opportunities to learn and grow, that suffering gives us an opportunity to obtain a kind of perfection that we would never see otherwise. That's James chapter 1. To be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing, one must first go through suffering. But what are some of the blessings that we often don't consider? It's easy when we're around the Thanksgiving dinner table to be thankful for family. And that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's trite or unimportant to be thankful for family. And it's easy when you're around the Thanksgiving dinner table to be thankful for the food that's in front of you. And again, that's not trite or unimportant. That's not a bad thing to be thankful for the food that's before our eyes. Our homes, our jobs, our families, those sorts of things are obvious to us as things we should be thankful for. What I want to do in this lesson is take us in a different direction and consider some of the things that we should be thankful for that we don't always think about. We don't always consider. Sometimes the things that we hate the most, sometimes the things that we're just groaning the most about, sometimes the things that annoy us even our enemies, can be blessings if you look at them from a certain way. So what could you be thankful for that you maybe forgot to pray about or be thankful about on Thanksgiving Day a few days ago? Let's be thankful for discipline, first of all. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 1 says, "Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid." Sorry, that's in our family, we don't let Sterling say that word, but the Bible says it. But I love how bluntly he puts it, though. He puts it very bluntly, doesn't he? If you love discipline, you love knowledge. If you hate reproof, you're stupid. Plain and simple. And yet, for as simple a concept as that is, that's not typically the way we think of it. We don't find discipline to be a pleasant experience. The writer of Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 7 points this out very clearly. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. And yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. We don't always like discipline when we're in the midst of it, but we realize after the fact that it had a hidden treasure in there. There was a blessing that came along with the discipline. And that blessing can only be found when we're patient about our discipline, when we're willing to see it through to the end, both when we are administering it and when we are receiving it. I'll tell you something about preachers that you probably never realized, because you've always had really, really good, humble preachers. Preachers don't like getting criticized. We're not crazy about it. Especially after we think that we just knocked it out of the park. You know, when we've done a sermon that probably should have been included in the book of Acts, and somebody comes up and says, probably rethink that particular point, or I'm not sure if you used that verse correctly, or I think you took that out of context, or I think I would have said it differently. Oh, yeah? And of course, we're always nice, but we say, oh, that's some good thoughts. I'll think about that. What we're thinking in our head is really, you buffoon. You have no idea what I do all week long, do you? No, we don't really think that. But I don't know if it's just preachers, and I don't think it's just kids or anything like that, but we don't like getting disciplined. Criticism and discipline, those sorts of things grate us the wrong way, and that's what comes naturally. To feel good about ourselves comes naturally. To feel like we're awesome comes quite naturally. But when somebody comes along and deflates that self-impression, that is what really makes us uncomfortable. But like the two verses that we've read point out, if you don't take the opportunity to learn and grow, you are a fool. If you don't see the criticism as an opportunity, if you don't see the discipline as something that is meant to produce in you a growth and a maturity of some kind, you're a fool. And you've completely missed the blessing behind it. So I suppose on Thanksgiving, I should be grateful for the discipline that comes my way. Not just on Thanksgiving, I guess, but all year long, to be grateful for the criticism. Without discipline, I would never have had the foolishness knocked out of me, so to speak. I look at some of the sermons I did 10 years ago. I'm really glad I have not done them as a repeat since then. I look at some of the sermons I did last week, and I wonder why it is I'm still employed. But really, if we had not been disciplined along the way, would we ever have learned to become better? Better at our craft? Better at our hobbies? Better at our parenting or our relationships like marriage? Better at being a friend to somebody else who has a need? Better at being more charitable, being more kind, being more forgiving? If somebody had not criticized us, if somebody had not chastised us in some way along the way on that journey, we would not be who we are now. And I like myself a whole lot more now that I'm in my 30s than when I was in my 20s. This is not to say I have any kind of puffed up sense of self-worth or anything like that, but I'd rather be me now than me 10 years ago. And I think most people would agree with that assessment. Well, people would probably agree that they like me more than they did 10 years ago, but about yourself as well. And the reason why we like ourselves more as we age is because we see the way that discipline has helped us along the way. We see the way that people came to our aid when we needed it, when we needed our pride to be burst. Somebody came along and blew up that bubble. And we appreciate that. That is what hindsight does for us. We might not enjoy it at the time. We might not have appreciated it at the moment. But looking back on discipline is one of the hidden treasures of the righteous person. And I am so thankful every time somebody criticizes or disciplines me, even if you're wrong about it. A couple of verses to think about. Proverbs 15, verse 10 says, "Stern discipline is for him who forsakes the way. He who hates reproof will die." There's death in the way of the person who doesn't listen to criticism. Proverbs 15, verse 32 says, "He who neglects discipline despises himself." And I like the way that that's put. If you neglect discipline, who are you hating? Are you hating the person who's criticizing you, or are you hating yourself? You are indirectly hating yourself. You are causing yourself to be hurt, to be held back, to be impeded somehow when you hate discipline. But he who listens to reproof, the writer goes on to say, acquires understanding. The next thing that I'm thankful for that one would not expect is my gray hair. And I know it gives me a George Clooney-esque quality. I appreciate that. In general, though, the aging process is often seen as more of a curse than a blessing. We don't always look at the way that we age. We don't always look at the components of our body as they break down. We don't look at those sorts of things as blessings. And we're not necessarily thankful all the time for our gray hair and the other signs of aging that typically come along with a person of relatively extended years. But I'm not going to complain too much. Every day seems to bring new wrinkles to my face, but I think the conscious awareness of my body's ceaseless decay is one of life's great unappreciated blessings. A couple of practical applications to consider on this point. First, the aging process is a reminder that I'm one day closer to being with God, that I'm one day closer to being with Christ in heaven. And I think that's a good sign. We get to this time of year after Thanksgiving, and typically by December 1st, we've got the Christmas decorations up, and a lot of families will put something up of a reminder of how far away Christmas is, a calendar or some kind of display on a table. We have a stuffed snowman who has a candy cane. You put the candy cane on the number of days that's left until Christmas, and we kind of count down until Christmas. Every time that candy cane moves, that's one day closer to Christmas, isn't it? And I suppose if I want to look at it in sort of a casual manner like that, every gray hair on the top of my head and every new wrinkle on my face is a reminder that I'm one day closer to finally meeting my Savior. I'm one day closer to finally claiming my reward in the afterlife. And that's a good sign. I don't mind that one tiny bit. My gray hairs are an ever-increasing sign of maturity and experience. I should never want to trade my veneration for my youth. Youth was awesome. Veneration brings with it blessings that we only realize until we get there. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 29 says, "The glory of young men is their strength, admittedly so, but the honor of old men is their gray hair." So I guess if that's the case, I should embrace it, shouldn't I? My gray hair represents the battles that I've fought in my life. They are a visible scar of the world's persistent effects on my mind and my body and the victories that I've won along the way, as well as the failures that I've met along the way that gave me reason to grow and learn and become a better person and a better Christian. Proverbs 16, verse 31. A gray head is a crown of glory. It is found in the way of righteousness. And I think one way to look at that idea of the gray head as the crown of glory is to look at it as that victory crown of you fought battles along the way. You've waged the war. Sometimes you've lost, but more often than not, you've met the victor. You've met the enemy and had victory. And the gray hairs on the top of your head are that victory crown that you get to wear that shows I've been there. Good friend of ours in Tucson, one of the deacons at the Northside Church of Christ in Tucson, good friend of ours, he looks at members in a congregation and he sees them as, pardon, it's his term, okay, blame him. Shannon Flyder, if you're watching this on the internet later, this is you. But he described older members of a congregation the way that you describe gorillas in a clan of gorillas, how they've got the silverbacks. You know, the really, really aged gorillas, the tough gorillas, the alpha males, the leaders in the group are the silverbacks. They've got a silver sheen on their backs from their hair turning gray. And he looks at Christians the same way also. He looks at older men and older women as being kind of the silverbacks of the congregation, the people who fought the battles, the people who've been there, who've held steady, who've been faithful all along the way. And now they have a place in our group. They have a place in our group, venerated, honored, respected. And again, I suppose if that's what comes along with gray hair, that's not something to ignore or downplay. So I'm thankful for my gray hair. I just don't want it to come too fast. I'm thankful for criticism. You know, we talked about discipline, but I want to kind of hone in a little bit more on the idea of criticism, especially the idea of sometimes when criticism is not correct. You ever get criticized about something and you know for a fact, and I'm not saying you're just confident of it, but you know for a fact that they're wrong? You get criticized about something and you actually know the facts verify that you actually had it right. You made the right call. You did the right thing. And you still got criticized for it. Are you still thankful for that criticism? There was one time where I was criticized and I called my dad about it. It was something that really cut me. It wasn't anybody here or anything like that. So don't be wondering, like, who would have said such a thing to him? It was true in hindsight, though. But it was the kind of criticism that really, really cut me to the core. It was something that just really, really got to me and bothered me so much that I actually called my dad like a weenie and had to get his consultation on this. And the person was wrong about the criticism. They were wrong about the criticism. They had judged my motives incorrectly on something that I had said from a sermon. And Dad said, yeah, you know, even if they're wrong about it, try to understand they said it from a certain perspective. They said it because you gave them the impression. So even if they were wrong about it, you still gave them something to work with. You gave that person an impression, a false impression, but you gave them something to work with. And that made me really think about that, that even when criticism is wrong, there's still something to be learned from it. There's still something to take away from it. The wise person never sets about his life without consultation and criticism. The wise person never goes about his life without seeking the knowledge of those around them and accepting the knowledge of those around them, even if that knowledge is incomplete. I like in Proverbs 15, verse 22, it says, without consultation, plans are frustrated, but with many counselors, they succeed. The more people you have around you, the more voices that you have contributing to your life, I think the better. Now, sometimes those voices are wrong, but that's why you have an abundance of counselors. That's why you surround yourself with a lot of people. Let's just say you have one person in your life, and you listen to that person. You trust that person implicitly, and you basically take whatever they say as gospel. Now, most of the time, that person's going to be right in their assessment of things. If you trust a person that much, surely they've earned your trust. But what about that one time they're wrong? What about that one time they're way off base? Boy, another voice would have been really helpful. The more voices that you surround yourself with in this life, the more likely it is that you are going to get an aggregate of good advice from people. You want to know how to raise kids? Don't just trust one person's advice on raising kids. Don't just read one self-help book. Don't just ask one person how to raise kids. Ask a lot of people. Ask a lot of people how to raise kids, because every kid is different. Every parent is different. Every experience that they've had with their kids is different. The abundance of knowledge that you then gain, some of it's going to be useful, some of it's not going to be useful. Marriage is the same way. If you're trying to build a healthy marriage, don't try to build a healthy marriage just by one person's model. That's how they made their marriage healthy. But what if that doesn't work for you? Well, that marriage advice wasn't any good to you. But when you surround yourself with advice on how to have a healthy marriage, and there's a lot of other applications as well, how to preach. If I wanted to be a good preacher, I'm not going to listen to just one other preacher. I'm not going to just fixate on one preacher and imitate everything about him. You listen to a lot of preachers. You listen to a lot of advice. You read a lot of books. Admittedly, there are times when we don't feel like getting criticized. We might not be in a particularly good mood that day. Or we might feel like we've just accomplished something great. That might be the least ideal time to take a beating from somebody else. And beyond that, we might have a tendency to ignore certain criticisms when we know just exactly what's coming from somebody. There are times, for instance, when we might continually make the same mistakes in life, And we keep getting the same criticism. And instead of changing, we just kind of roll our eyes. Like, well, here they come again, coming to tell me about that again. Well, you know, if you're tired of people criticizing you about the same thing over and over again, maybe stop making the same mistake over and over and over again. We need to be very careful to accept criticism for what it is, to embrace criticism for what it is. And if we resent correction, we're acting foolishly. The last point that I'll make this evening is this. I am thankful for my enemies. I'm very thankful for my enemies. We can tell a lot about ourselves by the way that we treat our enemies. In fact, I think we can tell more about ourselves by how we treat our enemies than how we treat our friends. And Jesus, I think, brings this point out in His Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 44, Jesus points out, I say to you, love your enemies. He said, don't just tolerate your enemies. Don't just put up with your enemies. Don't just put on a good show or put on a smiling face for your enemies. He says, love your enemies. That's really hard to do, though. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For He causes His Son to rise on the evil and the good, and He sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Don't even the tax gatherers do the same? Anybody can love the people who love them. That's easy. It's easy to love people who you really care about. It's easy to love people who are your family. It's easy to love people who do something for you. It's really hard to love the people who are not doing something for you. If you greet your brothers only, Jesus says, what do you do more than others? Don't even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect, He says, as your heavenly Father is perfect. It's easy to be thankful for friends, harder to be thankful for our enemies. Without enemies, our ability to love would never be challenged. You would never know what true love really is until that love was put to the test of a person who really pushed your patience, somebody who really pushed your buttons, or somebody who harmed you. I would never know the depth of my capacity for selflessness and forgiveness if I did not have an opportunity to be selfless and forgiving. Loving those who love you, as Jesus says, does not come with the reward. What is the reward then in this context? Perhaps it's the satisfaction of a clear conscience, or the peace that comes with forgiving others and knowing that you hold no debts against anybody else. Maybe the reward is knowing that you overcome your pettiness. That's quite a blessing, isn't it? It's quite a blessing to know that you have learned by the experience gained in loving your enemies how to become a bigger person, to be the better man in a situation. My enemies remind me that I too am also an enemy to somebody. I don't always like to admit it, but maybe I grate people the wrong way sometimes. Maybe I'm somebody's enemy. I know that we kind of look at the world around us and we see a lot of enemies out there. We see progressives and secular humanists. We see false religious masterminds. We see the prophets of the gospel of health and wealth. We see those who would push immorality on us and our families and our schools. And we think we've got a lot of enemies, but do you realize as a Christian, you're their enemy? You're their enemy. You are the enemy to them. And I think one thing to think about is not just how you treat your enemies, but how you also act as an enemy to somebody else. Shows a lot about who you are. You're somebody else's enemy out there. There is somebody out there who doesn't like you. How are you going to treat them? My enemies magnify the good people in my life. I think that's a great blessing. You ever think about that? The worse your enemies are, the more you appreciate the people who are really good in this life. The uglier other people are to you, the more rewarding it is to come home to a family who loves you dearly, to be around Christians who love you dearly. And that's one thing that I take away from the book of Revelation, which we just finished studying. But in Revelation chapter 21, the last couple of verses of Revelation 21 talk about how in that place, the New Jerusalem, in heaven, there will be no liars. There will be nothing unholy. There will be nothing unrighteous or filthy in that place, but only God's light filling corner to corner. And I think one of the greatest blessings of being in heaven is going to be surrounded by people who are wholesome, surrounded by people who are pure, surrounded by people who are righteous. The ugliness of this world magnifies the beauty of all the people in this room that work together. The ugliness of this world magnifies the Christians that I really care about in this life, the Christians who care about me. And that's a blessing we don't always think about. And finally, my enemies give me an opportunity to perfect the art of forgiveness. They help me recognize my own sinfulness and the need that I have for forgiveness through Jesus Christ. Matthew chapter 6, verses 14 and 15 points out that there's a correlation between the way you forgive other people and the way God forgives you. And if you can't learn to be a forgiving person, why would you ever expect God to forgive you for your trespasses? Having enemies reminds me of all of these things. So maybe these are not the typical things you might talk about when you're sitting around the Thanksgiving dinner table, talking about all your blessings and how thankful for you are for these things. But I think these are some of the things that if you really think about them hard, you realize these are greater blessings than a nice house, greater blessings than having a good job, greater blessings than even food on your table, because it is these kinds of blessings that produce in you that heavenly treasure that Jesus speaks so glowingly about in Matthew chapter 6. The heavenly treasure that we should be piling up for ourselves. The heavenly treasure that really is the eternal reward that we're waiting for, longing for in this life. So what are you thankful for? Most of all, let's be thankful for Jesus Christ, who is a blessing that we neglect and forget so often. We love our homes and we love our families and we love the food on our table. But do you love Jesus Christ every single day as much or more than you love those things? Let's be thankful for that. If you have any need at all, then I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.